Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Grab a drink and settle in because today we are heading out to the desert.
Yeah, we're looking at some seriously extreme engineering today. Glad to be here.
So to get us started, I want you to picture a very specific scene. You are standing right in the middle of the Arizona desert. It is, 120 degrees in the shade, assuming you can even find any shade.
Right, which you probably can't.
Exactly. The air is just incredibly dry. And there is this fine red dust coating absolutely everything in sight.
It's basically a hostile environment. I mean, biologically, for humans, sure, but mechanically, it is an absolute nightmare for electronics.
It really is. And right in the middle of this blistering heat, you have this fleet of rugged electric vehicles. They call them curb cars. And these vehicles are out there trying to keep a decentralized network alive.
Which is fascinating because normally when we talk about network infrastructure, we're talking about pristine air-conditioned server rooms in Northern Virginia.
Right. Not a dusty dashboard baking in the sun.
Yeah.
We are talking about the literal physical edge of the network here. And that setting is what makes the sources we are looking at today so incredibly interesting.
Oh, absolutely. We've got our hands on a stack of internal technical reports from a company called DeReticular, and they are trying to solve a problem that sounds almost impossible on paper.
They're trying to build what they call a civilization in a box.
Yeah, a global, completely resilient network infrastructure. But here is the catch, and this is really the core conflict we're going to unpack today. They have to choose between consumer grade and industrial grade.
And as anyone in hardware knows, you usually do not get to pick both.
No, you don't. It's the classic engineering dilemma. If you want to put a modem in a tank or an oil rig or a factory floor, you buy industrial gear.
You buy Cisco, you buy Siemens.
Exactly. Gear that's rated for extreme heat. It's
Ah.
vibration proof. It's completely dust sealed. But it also costs $2,000 or $3,000 a unit.
Which is fine for an oil rig. But DeReticular is trying to scale this decentralized network massively. You can't just drop $2,000 on a modem for every single curb car if you want thousands of these nodes out there.
It would bankrupt the project before it even started. So the strategy they've outlined in these documents, it's honestly audacious. They call it their sovereign node architecture.
It sounds super fancy, but what it actually means when you look at the schematics is that they are taking cheap, off-the-shelf consumer gadgets.
Stuff you would literally buy on Amazon for a weekend vacation.
Right. And they are surgically altering them to survive the apocalypse.
It's high-tech upcycling. They're effectively voiding warranties for the greater good.
I love this concept so much because it really feels like a return to that old-school garage hacker ethos. So our mission today is to unpack this architecture. Let's start with the connectivity piece, the Nomad Link.
Okay, so the base of this unit is a little device called the Skylink Global SLG06. If you're a digital nomad or you travel a lot for work, you might actually have one of these sitting in your desk drawer right now.
It's just a little plastic puck. Costs what, like 140 bucks?
About that, yeah. It is a consumer travel hotspot designed to sit on a cafe table in Paris.
Okay, so let me play the skeptic here. If I'm building critical infrastructure, why on earth am I trusting a $140 plastic puck? Why wouldn't I just bite the bullet and use the industrial standard, like a Teltonika router?
That's a logical question. But the sources highlight two very specific reasons why the cheap toy actually wins out here. And the first one is raw speed. This Skylink device is LTE Category 6.
Okay, let's unpack that for a second. What does Cat 6 actually get us in the real world compared to the expensive rugged stuff?
Well, it means it can pull down around 300 megabits per second. Now, if you look at the standard industrial workhorse, like the Teltonika RUT956, which is a fantastic device, built like a literal tank, it often caps out at Cat 4.
Which is only 150 megabits, right?
Exactly, half the speed.
So the cheap consumer device is literally twice as fast as the heavy-duty industrial one. That seems totally backwards.
It does feel backwards. But you have to think about product life cycles. Industrial gear is built to be stable and supported for 10 or 15 years, so they use older, highly proven silicon.
They don't take risks.
Right. Whereas consumer tech is built to be fast right now, the market moves at a breakneck pace. So for raw throughput, the cheap puck wins.
Okay, that makes sense. Speed is factor one. What's the second reason?
VS technology. This is honestly the killer feature for a decentralized global network. The SLG06 works in over 140 countries without you ever having to touch a physical SIM card.
Oh, wow. That is huge for logistics.
It's everything. Think about it. If you are deploying these curb cars to Uganda, Chile, and Arizona, you do not want to manage thousands of tiny plastic SIM cards. You don't want to negotiate individual carrier contracts for every region.
And you definitely don't want a technician trying to swap out a SIM card on the side of a dirt road because the vehicle crossed a border.
Exactly. This device is deployment ready anywhere on Earth the absolute second you turn it on.
Okay, so it's incredibly fast and it's globally compatible. But we have to go back to the desert for a minute. This is a plastic puck designed for an air-conditioned coffee shop. You stick this thing on a dashboard in Phoenix in July, what actually happens?
The engineering report calls this the fatal flaw. And it all comes down to the battery.
Ah, the spicy pillow.
The spicy pillow, yes. The spec sheet for the SLG06 says the safe operating temperature is 0 to 40 degrees Celsius. In a vehicle dashboard sitting in the sun, you are hitting 70, maybe 75 degrees Celsius easily.
And there's a lithium-ion pouch cell inside that plastic case.
Which is wildly dangerous. You absolutely cannot leave a consumer-grade lithium battery plugged into a charger 24/7 in 70-degree heat.
Because the electrolyte breaks down, right?
Right. It generates gas, the battery physically swells up like a balloon, and it starts crushing the delicate electronics from the inside out. And eventually—
Until it catches fire.
It catches fire.
So it's literally a ticking time bomb sitting in the vehicle.
It is. And this is where the Duraticular hardware strategy really kicks in. They don't just use the device as is, they hack it. They perform what they call the BEC modification.
Battery elimination circuit. Walk us through this because this is where we get into the real void your warranty engineering.
Yeah, so the first step is purely physical. They crack open the plastic case and they just rip out that 4,000 milliamp hour battery. They recycle it immediately. It never even sees the field.
So now you just have a hotspot with a giant empty hole in the back.
Right. So they 3D print a spacer. They call it a dummy battery that fits perfectly into that exact slot.
Huh.
But hidden inside that plastic spacer, they wire in a DC-DC buck converter.
Just to clarify for the listener, why a buck converter specifically? Why not just use a cheap, simple linear regulator to drop the voltage?
It all comes back to heat, efficiency, and sheet. The curb car has a massive 48-volt power supply. If you used a simple linear regulator to drop 48 volts down to the 4 volts the hotspot needs, the wasted energy gets burned off as heat.
Which is exactly what we're trying to avoid in the desert.
Precisely. A buck converter steps that voltage down efficiently. It transforms the 48 volts to a clean, steady 4.0 volts, perfectly mimicking a battery without generating all that thermal waste.
Okay, but here's where I get a bit skeptical. I've actually tried to run old cell phones without batteries before. You take the battery out, plug it into the wall, and they just boot loop. They totally freak out because the software can't see the battery.
And you have just hit on the most critical detail in their engineering notes. Most smart devices have a hard-coded safety check. The SLG06 firmware checks a very specific pin on the battery connector. It's called the BSI.
The battery status indicator.
Right. It is looking for a thermal reading from a thermistor inside the battery. It wants to know the temperature to make sure it isn't overheating. If the battery is completely gone, that pin is technically open.
So the device assumes the battery is either missing or completely destroyed.
Yep. And it refuses to boot up at all to prevent any damage.
So how do they get around a firmware lock like that?
With a 10-cent component. They solder a 10K ohm resistor directly between the BSI pin and the negative terminal.
Wait, really? Just a simple resistor? What does that actually do?
It creates a specific electrical resistance that spoofs a valid thermal reading. It essentially tricks the firmware into thinking, oh, I have a perfectly healthy battery attached, and it is sitting at a nice, cool room temperature.
That is incredibly clever. You are literally lying to the software to make the hardware survive the environment.
Exactly. And that little lie allows the device to boot up and run cleanly off the car's hardline power forever. No battery to swell, no fire risk.
But legally speaking, this has got to be a nightmare.
Oh, right? Absolutely. The report is very explicit about this. It says, in bold text, this modification voids the Skylink warranty. You cannot send this thing back to the manufacturer for repair.
Because you Frankensteined it.
Right. So Duraticular effectively becomes the manufacturer of this new hybrid device. They have to offer their own sovereign warranty for it. They turned a fire hazard into a fire-safe industrial bridge, but they had to break all the rules to do it.
It's just such a great example of that industrial versus consumer tension. They desperately wanted the software features of the consumer toy, but they needed the hardware reliability of the industrial tank. So they just built the hybrid themselves.
Exactly.
Okay, so that gets the curb car online. We have a data pipe, but a pipe needs data flowing through it, and we need a brain to tell the car what to do. That brings us to the second piece of the puzzle, the Rios telemetry core.
This is the actual computer that runs the vehicle's logic. And once again, they did not go for a $500 industrial controller. They went with the Raspberry Pi 5, specifically the 8 GB model.
Now, I have a Pi 4 sitting on my desk at home. I use it to block ads on my network. It's a hobbyist board. Why on earth are they relying on it for industrial telemetry? Is it just the cost factor again?
Cost is definitely a factor, but the documents argue it's actually about the underlying chip architecture. The Pi 5 uses the Broadcom BCM2712 chip.
Which is an absolute beast compared to the older generation.
It really is. In fact, it's massive overkill for basic data logging. If you were just recording simple GPS coordinates, you could use a $5 Arduino microcontroller. But these curb cars are doing something much heavier. They are running serious cryptographic workloads.
This connects to the Locutus ledger that's mentioned in the reports, right?
Right. Locutus is a scalable, completely decentralized data store. You can think of it as the next evolution of Freenet. The car isn't just passively sending data to a centralized server somewhere. It is actively participating in a mesh network. It has to sync this ledger and generate what they call proof of movement.
Proof of movement? That sounds a lot like proof of work in Bitcoin.
It's a very similar concept. The car has to cryptographically prove that it actually drove from point A to point B. And that involves signing data packets, hashing GPS coordinates, and continuously verifying signatures from other nodes.
That is heavy math.
Really heavy. Previous generations of the Pi would have choked or lagged under that load. The Pi 5 can actually handle it.
But we run into the exact same enemy we saw with the hotspot, right? Heat. I mean, the Pi 5 runs hot, just sitting on my desk in an air-conditioned room.
It is notorious for running hot. The report notes that the board will start thermal throttling, meaning it artificially slows down its processor to save itself from melting at 80 degrees Celsius.
And in that Arizona dashboard, you are already halfway to 80 degrees just from the ambient sun. Passive cooling isn't going to cut it.
Not at all. You can't just stick a little copper heatsink on it and call it a day. They wrap the entire board in an aluminum armor case. The whole thick metal case acts as a giant thermal mass to pull heat away. And then they pair that with an active blower fan.
A spinning fan in a super dusty desert environment seems like a massive failure point waiting to happen.
It certainly can be. And that is why the custom programming is key here. The fan is set via software to only kick in when the board goes above 60 degrees Celsius. They rely on the passive aluminum case for as long as physically possible to avoid sucking in dust. It's a real brute force approach to thermal management.
Now, there is another bottleneck mentioned in this section that I think anyone who has ever messed around with a Raspberry Pi has suffered through at least once. The micro SD card.
Oh, the absolute bane of every Pi user's existence.
Seriously, I've had them completely corrupt just from unplugging the power cord at the wrong second.
Exactly. Micro SD cards are just not designed for constant heavy read-write cycles, and they definitely aren't designed to handle the intense vibrations of a vehicle driving over dirt roads. If the power cuts unexpectedly while the database is writing a block to the card, the entire file system corrupts.
And then your car's brain is effectively bricked.
Yep. Dead in the water.
So did they just ban SD cards entirely?
Completely banned for the operating system. The report states they use an NVMe SSD, the exact same kind of solid-state drive you would find in a high-end gaming laptop, connected via a PCIe H8T that sits right on top of the Pi.
So it's solid-state, it's vibration-proof, and it's way faster.
And it is absolutely crucial for the ledger. Decentralized databases do a massive amount of tiny reads and writes constantly. A standard SD card would wear out in months. These NVMe drives will last for years out in the field.
Now, there was one tiny component listed in the build materials for this build that I honestly almost missed reading through. It costs about $1.50. It's a Panasonic ML2020 battery. Just looks like a little silver coin.
Right.
Why is this listed as a critical component?
I love this part. This is one of my favorite details in the whole report because it connects directly to their island mode concept. See, the Raspberry Pi 5 finally has a real-time clock, or RTC, built right onto the board.
But it doesn't actually come with a battery to keep that clock running if the main power goes out.
Exactly.
So if the car battery dies, or a mechanic disconnects the main power, the Pi wakes back up thinking it is. What time?
Usually it defaults to January 1st, 1970, the beginning of Unix time.
Okay, which is super annoying. But why is that deemed mission critical?
Because cryptography relies heavily on accurate time. If you were trying to sign a proof of movement and your system timestamp says it's 1970, the blockchain, or the Lacutus ledger in this case, will completely reject it.
Because it sees it as invalid spoofed data.
Exactly. The network says, hey, this car claims to be moving 50 years in the past, block this transaction.
So the telemetry data becomes totally worthless.
Instantly worthless. That tiny $1.50 coin battery ensures that even if the curb car sits dead in a field for a month, the moment it wakes up, it knows exactly what time it is. It keeps the crypto valid.
It really is the difference between a toy and an industrial tool.
Precisely. Sweating the small details.
So we've got the Nomad Link for the connection, and we have the telemetry core for the brain. Mm. That covers the mobile side of things, the curb cars. But the documents also dive into a stationary unit. The sovereign sentry.
Right. This is for the infrastructure, the farms, the rural clinics, the home offices. This is the literal civilization in a box. Hmm. And this is where the hardware architecture shifts gears completely. We aren't using ARM chips like the Pi anymore. We are moving up to x86 architecture.
The docs recommend a fanless mini PC, something running like an Intel N100 or an i3.
Right. Low power draw, but very robust. And they use a software strategy here called hyperconverged infrastructure.
Okay, that sounds like pure IT buzzword bingo to me. Break that down for us.
I know, it sounds incredibly complex, but think of it like a Swiss Army knife versus carrying around a heavy tool belt. Instead of buying a separate physical router, a separate data server, and a separate security firewall, which would be three physical boxes, you buy one powerful mini PC.
Okay.
Then, using a hypervisor software called Proxmox, you run three virtual machines inside that one single box.
So it's basically three imaginary computers sharing one physical brain.
Exactly. And doing this saves money, it saves physical space, and crucially, it saves power.
All right, so let's meet the three ghosts in the machine here.
Yeah.
Who are the players running inside this box?
First up, you have the VM they call the Gatekeeper. That is running pfSense.
Which is serious enterprise-grade routing stuff.
It is. It's an open-source firewall and router. It manages all the local network traffic. But its real superpower in this setup is failover. Imagine you have a Starlink dish mounted on your farm roof. That's your high-speed main internet. But a massive storm hits, and the Starlink loses connection.
The Gatekeeper notices the drop.
Instantly. And it automatically switches all the farm's network traffic over to the backup connection, which is that 4G Nomad Link we talked about earlier. The user streaming a video or syncing a database might not even notice the switch happened. It keeps the farm online seamlessly.
That is incredibly smart.
Yeah.
Okay, what about VM number two?
They call that one the Ledger. This is the Rios core running Freenet and Lacutus. In the notes, they actually call it the moneymaker.
Why the moneymaker?
Because this is where the actual network value is generated. It hosts the static storage things like offline repair wikis for the farm equipment. So you can figure out how to fix your tractor even if the global internet is totally down.
Mm.
But it also runs the smart contracts that track network credits and payments.
The report mentions a pretty big hardware constraint here, right? RAM?
Yeah, massive constraint. A lot of this decentralized software is Java-based. And Java eats memory like crazy. That is why the baseline specs for the Sentry call for 32 gigabytes of RAM. The Ledger VM just needs a lot of room to breathe.
Makes sense. And then there is VM number three. They call it the Auditor. This is the one that felt the most, I don't know, cyberpunk to me. It is running Kali Linux.
It really is a unique twist because usually Kali Linux is a tool used strictly by hackers. You use it for penetration testing, actively trying to break into systems.
So why on earth is it running 24/7 on a defensive rural farm server?
It is there to hack itself.
Wait, excuse me.
It acts as an automated immune system. Think about it. Most smart home or IoT devices are totally passive. They just sit there on the network waiting to be exploited by a botnet. The Auditor VM runs automated vulnerability scans using tools like OpenVS and Nmap on its own local network continuously.
So it is actively patrolling the farm's network.
Constantly. It is asking questions like, hey, did someone just plug in a cheap security camera with a default admin password? Is there a random port left open on the tractor's diagnostic printer that shouldn't be? If it finds a hole, it alerts the owner so they can patch it before a bad actor can exploit it.
That is just fascinating. It literally replaces the router, the server rack, and the cybersecurity team. That is the whole civilization in a box value prop realized.
And it does it all locally, offline if necessary.
But there is a missing piece here, isn't there? We have the rugged machines, we have the mesh network, we have the automated security. But what about the people? Because in a decentralized mesh, establishing trust is incredibly hard. If a solar panel breaks and I claim I went out and fixed it, how does the network know I actually did the work? How do we prove a human was physically there?
This brings us to the final piece, the sovereign key. This addresses the human element of the architecture.
The document describes this thing as a customized YubiKey 5C NFC. I actually have a YubiKey for my email security. It's just a little USB stick on my keychain.
It's the exact same hardware, but a completely different application. In this ecosystem, it acts as what they call the physical root of trust. It securely holds the private key associated with the user's sovereign badge.
Which is essentially an NFT living on a ledger.
Correct. It is your unforgeable digital credential.
So let's walk through a real-world scenario. Let's say I am a field technician. I drive my current car up to a broken solar inverter out in the middle of nowhere. I fix the wiring. Now I want to log the job and get my network credits. What happens?
Well, you don't just pull out a tablet and type in a password. Passwords can be stolen from halfway across the world. You physically plug your sovereign key into the dashboard of the curb car.
Okay, and then what?
The car's internal system wakes up and issues a cryptographic challenge. It basically sends a long random string of numbers to your key and says, hey, sign this with your private key to prove it's you.
And I just touch the little gold button on the stick.
You touch the sensor. And that physical touch is the crucial part. It proves a living human is physically present in the vehicle. It's called user presence verification. The key signs the data entirely inside its secure element. The private key never actually leaves the device, and it sends the digital signature back to the car.
And then the car checks that signature against a blockchain.
Right. The car looks at the public Lacutus ledger and says, okay, this mathematical signature perfectly matches the sovereign badge for technician number 42. Access granted. It unlocks the admin panel, and you can log the repair.
So even if someone hacked my password or they successfully phished me, it wouldn't matter at all?
Not one bit. Unless they physically stole that little stick from your pocket and knew your PI, they cannot impersonate you on the network.
But that leads right into the scary part. If I lose the key, do I just lose my entire digital identity? That sounds terrifying if my whole professional reputation is stibbled on a piece of plastic that can fall in the dirt.
That is a very valid fear. But they thought of that. They have a fail-safe built-in called the Dead Man Protocol.
How does that work?
If you realize you lost your key, you immediately log into the Central Academy portal, presumably through some backup recovery method or biometric verification, and you issue a revocation command.
It's like calling the bank and canceling a lost credit card.
Exactly like that. That revocation command propagates instantly through the mesh network to every single node, every curb car, every sovereign sentry. They all update their internal revocation list.
So if someone found my key in the dirt 10 minutes later and tried to plug it into a vehicle,
the car would instantly reject it. It would say, this key is burned. It effectively severs the digital link to that physical object, turning it into a useless piece of plastic.
It really is a remarkably robust system. You have physical security, digital cryptography, and a global kill switch.
It has to be robust. If you are literally building civilization in a box, you have to assume that bad guys are going to try to pry the box open.
So let's take a step back and look at this whole ecosystem. It is pretty staggering when you lay it all out together.
It really is a marvel of integration.
You've got the Nomad Link, which is this hacked Frankenstein connectivity pipe using melted consumer toys. You have the telemetry core, the robotized brain struggling against the desert heat with its special armor. You've got the sentry, the stationary fortress, keeping the farm safe with its own immune system. And then the key, physically proving who you are.
And the common thread running across all of them, the philosophy that ties the heat management, the crypto, and the hardware hacks together, is this core concept of island mode.
That's the real why behind all this extreme engineering. Explain island mode a bit more for the listener.
Normally, our modern tech is entirely dependent on the cloud. If Amazon Web Services has an outage on the East Coast, your smart doorbell suddenly stops working. Your thermostat forgets its schedule. Your voice assistant goes completely deaf.
We are totally tethered to servers we don't own.
We are rented. We don't own anything. Deriticular is building for a world where that connection might be permanently cut. The curb car needs to log critical infrastructure data, even if it is 100 miles from a cell tower. The farm needs to access repair wikis, even if the satellite is completely down.
its ultimate resilience.
It's true independence. It is about identity and data being held physically by the user and the local device, not renting access to it from a server farm in another country. It is admitting that the cloud is just someone else's computer. And sometimes you really need your own computer.
You know, I think what sticks with me the most from all these documents is the vivid image of that garage phase described in the fulfillment report. You just picture these technicians popping open cheap plastic cases, recycling lithium batteries so they don't explode, and hand soldering resistors onto circuit boards.
It's very visceral, isn't it? It isn't a sterile corporate clean room.
Not at all.
Yeah.
It feels like a return to a time when we actually owned our hardware, when we didn't just accept the consumer-grade limitations handed to us. They aren't accepting that this device shouldn't work in the heat. They're actively voiding the warranty to force it to build something better.
High-tech functionality built on voided warranties. I think that sums up the entire DeReticular ethos perfectly.
But it does leave me with one final thought, something for everyone listening to mull over. If this sovereign infrastructure actually takes off, what happens when the major manufacturers start fighting back?
Ah, the DRM wars.
Exactly. If companies start hard-coding cryptographic checks into their batteries to prevent these bypasses, the next big tech war won't just be over software copyrights. It will be a DRM war over physical hardware. Who truly has the right to modify the things they buy?
That is a battle that's definitely coming.
Well, a huge thank you to the team for sending over these internal documents. And it's a rare look under the hood of how industrial infrastructure is actually cobbled together when you are on a tight budget and an absolutely critical mission.
It certainly makes you look at that old travel hotspot sitting in your drawer a little differently.
It sure does. I might go check mine for a spicy pillow right now. Thanks for listening, everyone. Go void some warranties out there safely, of course. We will catch you on the next deep dive.